The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, with Americans divided over climate change, communicating the issue can be a daunting task. We'll speak with a University at Buffalo researcher who says storytelling is the key to finding solutions for a warming climate. And a Colgate University physics professor's research on oysters could lead to advancements in the medical and construction industries. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Humans are storytellers. Stories preserve history, create community, mobilize, and entertain. And storytelling can be key to changing minds and reaching solutions. Dr. Helen Wong is a professor of communication at the University at Buffalo. She is the co-editor of a new book that makes the case that storytelling can be used to advocate for solutions to the climate crisis. The open access book, Storytelling to Accelerate Climate Solutions, showcases effective climate storytelling in education, journalism, literature, and entertainment in a range of media. The topic of climate change can be divisive, notably in American politics. Some people are resistant to the idea of climate change, and while climate could be a motivator for many, others might feel deflated, that they can't do anything to stop a warming planet. Wong says it's important to understand what well-designed stories can achieve. I asked her how storytelling can change minds.
First of all, this issue is extremely complex. And, you know, for people who know more about it, you feel like, you know, you can only do so much and you try your best. And then we talk about the limited resources. We advocate for certain things through the book and to different stakeholders. But for other people, you know, we understand, you know, everybody comes from different backgrounds. You have your own circumstances, your own sort of interests and priorities in life. A lot of stuff gets in the way. And for a lot of people, it may not seem to be a real crisis. And it's unfortunate, I think, especially the role of digital communication networks these days sort of exacerbates these kind of very siloed, you know, loops, you know, we call the echo chambers, right? You keep getting the messages from people you trust, you love, and saying the same thing again and again in different ways, and you might feel like, nope, I guess that is the case, I agree, and I've got other things going on in my life, why should I care? So I think it's a wide range in terms of how we meet people where they are. And I think storytelling is very unique in the way that it provides different entry points for different folks, right? For some people, it might be more about learning what's really going on, why facts and science and the evidence and actually science-based solutions are there. And in what way can you connect personally in terms of what you can do about it? Because a lot of us, we might care, but we've got a really, you know, a lot going on all the time. And we don't know what to do about it. It's overwhelming, right? So one of the things we talked about, you know, in the book is, you know, one of the three gaps is called messaging, right? So if we're talking about how can we make climate change communication more effective, you know, of course, you know, what are we communicating about and with who and where? So one of the things is to say we have to keep the messages clear and simple, and they need to be repeated in some way from different sources that are perceived as trustworthy, credible, and they need to be easy and fun and compelling. So these all sound very simple, but they're very, very hard to do.
You mentioned fun and compelling, and I think that those are two words. When we talk about entertainment as an effective way of communicating, there have been movies that have been made about climate change and natural disasters. There are TV shows. There's a lot out there. But when it comes to entertainment and climate entertainment, if you will, is that necessarily the most effective way? Can that more easily be dismissed than, say, the gloom and doom, if you will?
Yes, very much so in terms of what people might perceive. Like, you know, for me, for decades, like we have to explain, like, what you're seriously studying entertainment? Like, who would take you seriously if you think, you know, this can really change the world? And I think we tend to take it for granted in terms of how much entertainment media is sort of really saturated in our everyday life experiences, that sort of consciously or subconsciously shaping who we really are. You know, it really shapes our minds and our actions. And you're right. I think, you know, if you're thinking about entertainment as the industry in the United States, there's a lot more to be done. We might have seen examples that touches upon, you know, climate a little bit here and there. There's more efforts behind the scene to try to be more elaborate and trying different examples. Yes, humor is important to get attention, to help people remember, but also like how is it connected to taking actions, right? So I think what we try to do in this book is to bring a really selected group of people together, you know, from different disciplines, different sectors, different experiences, and share with us in terms of what has worked very well and for what purpose. And if the purpose is to get people's attention and to bring them together, you know, some strategies might work better than others. And one of the major goals, as we stated in the beginning of the book, is to kind of facilitate the building of a community of practice. And we have now already seen, since the publication of this book in the summer, it's only been a couple months, sort of how, for example, the Natural Resources Defense Council, this is a very well-known international environmental advocacy group based in the U.S. but has all kinds of work around the globe, connecting with the entertainment industry in Hollywood, for example. So actually one of their major members of the Rewrite the Future program is now in charge of the sustainability storytelling at Netflix. So there are some changes in terms of the bigger initiatives, and you now see Hollywood has the Hollywood Climate Summit. And, you know, looking at bigger initiatives in terms of how can we scale up? Yes, as the creative professionals, they might argue, which I work with them all the time, Hollywood, Bollywood producers and writers, like, we don't want it to be too preachy. You know, and it's gonna affect the commercial success of the programming, which will never happen, right? But there are very good examples and good ways in terms of using narrative as a form, as a platform to engage massive audiences very effectively and bring them together, connecting to them to resources. And I think one of the challenges about the climate crisis is also sort of feeling that loneliness. Even if you kind of care, you feel like, what can I really do as one person? What difference does it make? But if you know, you're not alone. There are so many people who have been doing this, and for actually a long time, there are existing effective solutions, but they have the trouble to get the word out. You know, we use a parallel, I think, towards the end of the book about the medical community. It's kind of known, on average, it takes about 17 years for the cutting-edge medical research findings to be translated into practice, you know, in our everyday life. That's a long time. But yet, we've just been going through the COVID-19 global pandemic. We saw how you can escalate it very quickly at different levels all around the world. So it's not impossible. It is very, very difficult. So what we are trying to advocate here is, if we were to really focus, and we are working with a very tight sort of timeline, what are some of the things that we can really amplify? So you mentioned the doom and gloom, right? And is it really constructive for us to really focus on, be it the news reporting or the entertainment, you know, broadcast or, you know, even streaming shows, to really just to say, okay, how bad it can be? Is it really constructive? Right. So one of the things we talked about is we need to really shift from issue-oriented storytelling to action-oriented storytelling. So just because something might have different implications, like a new technology could be used for good or bad, storytelling can be used to control people, to manipulate people, or to bring people together and do something that's for the public good. We advocate for things that we focus on what's already working and amplify what's already working. That's more efficient. So hope should not be blind hope, but to know who's out there, how can I connect to me, be it the geographic location, be it the issue of interest, you know, so that you have these kind of entry points, as I was saying, different entry points for different people, meeting them where they are, so that you're not doing it alone, and you have a community. And storytelling is very good at that in terms of bringing people together, showing them what are the alternatives that's possible, right? So I think, so those are some of the things we try to accomplish through this book project.
And even if you're a dismissive or a disengaged person when it comes to the issue of climate change, storytelling is how humans communicate.
Oh, absolutely.
We're not reading academic writing every day. I mean,
no. Although it helps in some way for some people, but not at the scale we would have liked. And I, you know, I was just in preparation for this conversation, I was thinking, you know, this is not new to most folks, where, you know, we as Homo sapiens, you know, this capacity of storytelling really sets us apart from other species on the planet. And, you know, sort of being able to convey very complex ideas and emotions, especially at the emotional level, I think being able to evoke very profound human emotions through storytelling, it's really, really powerful. And we've seen that.
So we spoke about the need to bring people together when shaping stories in media, in games and movies, and bringing research to the table in the communication industry. But what are some of the other limitations and gaps? I'm thinking time and money, you know, it comes to mind. But what are some of the big gaps that are preventing effective climate change communication?
You're right. I think the item number one we were advocating in terms of a gap is funding. And I was actually astonished. You know, I'm in academia, you know, I work, you know, on different projects at different scales. And I was quite surprised when I was able to listen to the climate communication communicators, or, you know, the trained professionals, how limited the resources are, like not to have be paid or paid adequately for the job they do, and not being allowed to have, you know, sort of a projects and have sustained support to really implement what they know that can be really effective. And that's heart-wrenching. And at the higher scale in terms of a governmental support, in terms of infrastructure. And so that's why we put it up as the most important, you know, sort of a issue we wanted to advocate for more funding in terms of just supporting those who have been deeply in the trenches working on this issue for a long, long time and know the ins and outs of how it can work, but just not being able to do it or do it sufficiently, right, and sustainably. Yeah, so that's one of the things. The other things, you know, we talked a little bit about coordination, and towards the end of the book, you know, I tend to use this keyword called alignment. I think, you know, if you're lucky, you have decent support and you can build a team or community together, you know, how do you design it and implement it in an intelligent or smart way? Because I think a lot of the initiatives we hear about is like, okay, great, you're lucky, and you have the goodwill, the good intention, and you get some funding, you do it for a little while, then you move on to another thing, which would be a problem. And how can we align the interdisciplinary partnerships with the specific climate action goals and objectives? And also sort of match it with the kind of stories we tell, the narrative elements and the communication channels that they are shared through. And like I said, one of the easiest things to do is to connect to people to new or existing resources. It's not like nobody should be reinventing the wheel every single time. It's not possible, and it's not, you know, effective. And there are a lot of resources, actually, if you really started looking. So what we try to do is to kind of group them together. Like if you're interested in comedy, humor, there's your entry point. You can connect to all these people and groups and in different regions, you know. So, and also sort of a, the role of research. You know, I'm a researcher, I advocate for that because, you know, if you want to understand if you're actually making any difference whatsoever, you need to have a mechanism built in from the start to monitor your progress and to actually demonstrate your progress. And I think, you know, visualizing in some way or sharing what's going on is very powerful in terms of making a difference. And so we talk about all of these key components and how they really need to be better aligned rather than disconnected. So I think, you know, the silos make it so hard. So some people, even if they decide to devote their own efforts, you know, in climate change communication or climate action and empowerment, you get kind of drained after a while, feeling like you're just doing this alone or with a few folks, right? So we try to say, no, you shouldn't be alone. Nobody should be doing this alone. Yeah.
Dr. Helen Wong is a professor of communication at the University at Buffalo. She is co-editor of Storytelling to Accelerate Climate Solutions. The open access book is published by Springer. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Oysters are more than a culinary delicacy. An international research team recently used the Canadian light source at the University of Saskatchewan to unlock the secrets of oyster glue. Researcher Rebecca Metzler, a professor of physics at Colgate University, is studying oysters living in African rivers and lakes. The mollusks produce a special adhesive that scientists say could have uses from dental care to construction. I spoke with Professor Metzler about her research.
I've actually done research on two different types of oysters. So one is found in the oceans, and it's probably the kind of oyster that most people think of. It's called the eastern oyster. And then my most recent work was on a freshwater oyster that is found in rivers throughout Africa. And both of these oysters do things a little differently than, say, like mussels that people think of in, like, the Great Lakes and stuff like that, in terms of how they attach to either the shore or to each other or docks. And they produce adhesives that consist of both, like, an organic piece, which would be, like, proteins and stuff, and then a mineral piece, which for the one that comes out of the ocean, that is a mixture of these minerals called calcium carbonates, which have a couple of different forms. And then the one that is found in the freshwater system, it is just one type of calcium carbonate, which is called aragonite. And they, once they attach, they are stuck there for life, and they are filter feeders. So an important job for both types of oysters is essentially for us cleaning out the water to make it less polluted, to get rid of some of the sediment that floats through the water, all of that kind of stuff.
So do oysters eat everything that they need to actually produce this glue that they use to attach themselves to rocks or each other or what have you?
Yeah, that's another good question. So they do, they filter out from the water the nutrients that they need to be able to make both the shell that protects them and then also that adhesive. And the adhesive, we don't know exactly the mechanism by which they make it, but they are essentially taking elements out of the seawater or out of the freshwater and combining them in this way to be able to make this adhesive that has both hard components and soft components.
So are there any uses right now for this glue?
Yeah, so my research focuses mostly on like the fundamental science of like what is happening, what makes up the adhesive, how does it give the organism like material advantages. But I do work with an engineer at Purdue And he is doing some really cool work right now, especially on the marine oyster, and trying to synthesize adhesives based off of the information that we've been able to get from those marine oysters. So his name is John Wilkers, and he's at Purdue University. And he's made a great deal of progress. I think he's in the process of getting a patent, but nothing is out on the market yet.
Now, oyster shells themselves, what can you tell me about their structure? What are they made out of?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. The oyster shells are made out of materials that are actually pretty similar to the adhesive. So they are made out of calcium carbonates, and for the oyster that is in the freshwater environment, it's completely aragonite. Even though they have the same kind of composition, the same minerals, and they also have proteins and stuff, these oysters are able to control how they make the shell and how they make the adhesive so that they have different structures to give different materials properties.
So what do you mean by different structures?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so for the oyster that we've just been looking at, it's the one that is a little easier to describe. So the inside or the shell of the oyster is made up of what is called nacre, which is mother of pearl. And that structure essentially looks like a brick wall. So the mineral is like is brick, and the organic is essentially like the mortar around it. But the adhesive is actually this like nanoparticles, so really small particles, really small minerals, and the oyster somehow has made it so that at the outside portion of the adhesive, the part that's sticking to, say, a rock or another oyster, that part is pretty flexible because it's less dense, it's more disordered, and then as it gets closer and closer to the shell, it is more ordered and denser and harder and less flexible, and so it gives us kind of different materials properties depending on what it needs.
I know that there's a long evolutionary tree here, but are there any similarities that we can observe in oysters and people or animals? I'm thinking about bones and other structures within the body.
Yeah.
Is there a similarity somewhere along the line between the shell of a mollusk and the bone in a mammal?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, there's a lot of similarity. There's lots of differences, obviously, but there are a lot of similarities also. So our bones and our teeth are made up of calcium phosphate, whereas the mineral that the oyster uses is made up of calcium carbonate. So there's just a slight difference in the material makeup. But that being said, they can actually interact with each other pretty well. And so there has been some thought and some work looking into using some of the ideas that we find from oysters or other marine organisms that mineralize to think about how we can make better adhesives for like dental implants or ways that we can help with healing bones when we need to, say, like put a metal rod in instead of having a metal rod. Is there something else we can do to promote bone growth? So all of the ideas that we're learning from the mineralization process and oysters or other organisms, we try to then think about how we can use that to look at, say, humans.
So it may be one day that humans are walking around with oyster glue in their teeth, I guess.
Yeah,
is what you're
yeah
saying.
I mean, there's some thought of that, and there's other adhesives that people are playing around with that come from, like, biological organisms. And that's a lot of the really exciting work of working with biological organisms, especially ones that have evolved for so long to get to this point where they're succeeding still in their environment. It's like, what can we learn from them to then harvest that idea and put into play in a way that will be perhaps advantageous for us, and then, of course, advantageous for them as the climate changes.
Okay, so you've mentioned that these shells and structures are made out of calcium carbonate, which is the same ingredient, magic ingredient of Tums that you take as an antacid if you eat too much. But as we talk about the oceans getting more acidic, is there an interaction between a more acidic ocean water and the shells of marine animals?
Yeah, that's a great question. So There's definitely been some research looking into how acidity is going to impact different marine organisms, and we're finding that it depends on the organism, and that's what my work in the Gulf of Mexico is trying to focus on, is thinking about how different organisms are going to respond differently to these climate changes, with some organisms being able to withstand the changes that occur with acidity and temperature, and so thriving, and some not. And really, it likely depends on how they build up that mineral that they are using. Are they doing so through an intracellular process where they're able to control the environment, or are they really depending on that outside environment to be able to make that shell?
Rebecca, where will your research take you next? Will you be actually going out and collecting oysters anytime soon?
Yeah, that's a good question. So for right now, I am not working directly with oysters, but am focusing on a few other organisms and looking at how climate change is impacting them. So I have work in the Gulf of Mexico looking at like clams and other kind of bivalves and how they might be changing with the environment. And I'm working with a paleontologist and a biologist here at Colgate to do that work. And then I also work with someone at the College of New Jersey to think about how barnacles, which are another kind of filter feeder, might be impacted by climate change. And so we're running a variety of experiments to see what is happening to their shells, what is happening to how they adhere to things, what is happening to all of that process, so that we can start to make those predictions.
Rebecca, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me about your research. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I loved your questions. They were so good.
Rebecca Metzler is a physics professor at Colgate University who is researching adhesives produced by oysters. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. If you'd like to tell The Best of Our Knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to The Best of Our Knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit WAMCpodcasts.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1774. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Madeline Reynolds. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.